Meet inspectors. Don't even fart. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast celebrating the finest in films where helicopters explode. Now, in April this year, one of my favourite actors, Brian Dennehy, sadly passed away. 6'3", barrel-chested and with a booming voice, you could never fail to notice him whenever he turned up on screen. But what was also impossible to ignore was his acting talent. Despite his imposing physique, he was an actor capable of great range and subtlety, somebody who could be charismatic, charming, comedic, just as easily as he could be threatening or intimidating. So on this show, I wanted to pay my own tribute to the great man by looking at one of his films, 1990's The Last of the Finest. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who, whether he's first, second, or last, is always one of the finest. With me today is Matt Poirier from the DTV Connoisseur. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back. Well, it's always a fun time.
No, thrilled to have you back, especially for this show, because as I mentioned at the top here, Brian Dennehy was an actor that I have much admired over the years, and glad that you could join me, because like me, you're a bit of a big Brian Dennehy fan. So I wondered if you could sort of tell me what it is about him that you've liked and admired.
So, you know, when I first found out that there was a Brian Dennehy. I mean, I think I remember seeing FX or, you know, ads for FX and FX2 with Brian Brown. But I believe he was on a TV talk show here in the United States. It might have been Donahue or one of the daytime ones where he talked about playing John Wayne Gacy, in To Catch a Killer. Mm. And I was like pulled in by this. And of course, he said, like, you know, John Wayne Gacy wasn't happy. So I tracked the movie down. I saw it and I couldn't believe it. For me, it was the scariest movie that I still kind of think of it as the scariest movie I've ever seen. And that performance was one of the scariest. And that's kind of always struck. I mean, he's played a few characters, you know, not as bad as John Wayne Gacy, but there was the movie Gladiator that he did with,
yes.
Yeah, so Cuba Gooding Jr. Not to be confused with the
Russell Crowe.
The Russell Crowe one. But, that he was really great in that one. And then also there was, the sports channel here in the United States, ESPN, they were trying to make their own movies for a period. And they did a movie based on a book called A Season on the Brink about this, really kind of boorish, you know, horrible kind of college basketball coach here in the United States, Bobby Knight, who was really successful, but also was just really not a nice person. Mm. And he played that character as well. And it just, you know, these, like you talked about his size and his bigness, but he also had a way of using that to be, you know, menacing when he needed to be, but also, you know, giving characters a certain humanity when he needed to as well. And that presence on screen, I think it never left me, you know, from a young age. And so whenever I see him in anything, it's just, yeah, I'm always drawn to it. And I'm always excited to see his name on the tin for sure.
Yeah, and that performance that he gives in To Catch a Killer as John Wayne Gacy, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I completely agree with what you say. I mean, I think about how he uses his body as an actor. I mean, he's got an incredibly charismatic voice, but also he also is such a great physical actor, because in that film, you know, or where it's a sort of TV, I think it's a two-part TV miniseries, and, you know, within that, he's trying to, like, charm and lure these young men who he's ultimately going to kill. So you sort of see him, you know, full of, you know, trying to be this sort of charismatic charmer. He's full of sort of, you know, bonhomie. There's a sort of air of, you know, sexual suggestion there. And then at other moments in the film, he's trying to intimidate people, and he's using his size in a different way. And then later, you know, when the police are investigating these crimes and they're sort of interested in him, you know, he's trying to be sort of charm, you know, at different moments he's trying to be sort of, you know, charming and kind of joshing along with the police. And yeah, I think that TV movie, great microcosm of all these different things that Dennehy could do as an actor. And yeah, he's able to sort of harness them all in that particular role. And there's a real there's a real sinister quality to his performance in that film, which really reminded me very strongly of sort of Anthony Hopkins or turn in Silence of the Lambs or Brian Cox's actually performance of the same character in Manhunter.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, right, is that people always talk about that, right? They always talk about Anthony Hopkins and, that role in Silence of the Lambs as kind of being the ultimate. And I think maybe part of it because it was a TV movie. I think also, too, there's this sort of this fascination with serial killers that people somehow kind of, I don't know what the right term is. I don't say they idealize them, but there's this sort of way that people kind of view them in a certain different way. And Dennehy definitely smashes that idea. Like, John Wayne Gacy is not some kind of figure to be fascinated by in To Catch a Killer. He's a brutal killer. At the same time, we see like how much of a sociopath he is. And I think it's interesting. I think, and I don't know, maybe part of it too, again, the TV movie aspect, I think part of it. And I think people don't take Dennehy seriously the way they take Hopkins. And I think it's a shame because I agree. I think you can put that, his performance there up there with that. I mean, obviously John Wayne Gacy didn't like it. You know, he had an image he was trying to put out there of himself. He's this charmer still, even throughout his time in prison before he was executed. He was trying to continue to put out this image that he could charm people, and he did not like the performance that Dennehy did, which I think should speak to it. I mean, if the serial killer doesn't like your performance of them, that probably says you did a good job with it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Dennehy's it's a bit of a strange career in the sense of the fact that I don't think his screen career, either in TV or film, was really ever quite matched the heights of his talent. And, you know, Dennehy was also a very, very well-regarded stage actor as well. He won 2 Tonys in his career, which is the, you know, theatrical equivalent of the Oscar. And he clearly had, you know, great talent. And, you know, there's lots of actors who have come off the stage and become very big screen actors. You know, we've already mentioned Anthony Hopkins. You know, there is a prime example of somebody who made that transition from stage to screen. But somehow Dennehy, never really managed to sort of become as big on TV as he clearly was in the theatrical world.
Yeah, it's funny. I think it's part of it. He might fall into that trap. Michael Jai White, I saw in an interview recently, said something to the effect of, when you kick someone in the head, you get known for kicking people in the head, meaning like you get, you know, typecast as an action kind of guy. And I think him, you know, Dennehy, for his size and his menacing quality, that I think it's like, you know, once he got cast, I mean, he did a series of TV movies where he was, you know, playing a detective. And I think those were relatively popular back in the, you know, when the 80s and 90s, when TV movies in the U.S. were a bigger deal. You know, he did that kind of thing. But I think from the big screen standpoint, it was, I think, a mindset of either he's going to be the big heavy or like kind of the big bad guy, or we don't want him. There's no use for him. I think, you know, I think that's the sad part, because, you know, in a movie like what we're going to talk about, I mean, he can carry a movie. He, like you said, he's got the acting ability, and I think that's part of it. You know, the size is a big part of it, but the fact that someone can really act like Dennehy could made him somebody that had the quality that would have been better if he'd gotten more of a chance.
Okay, well, I think it's time to get stuck into The Last of the Finest. So let's hear a little bit of the trailer.
Well, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but me and Ricky are going swimming!
All their lives, they stood by what they believed in. Friends, family. But most of all,
freeze!
The law.
Be inspectors!
They were LA's finest. Nothing could break up this team. Until they got too close to a case no cop was supposed to solve.
You went in without a backup, without a warrant, without probable cause.
We're talking major drug money here.
First, they lost a friend.
I don't want to do any different.
You have been charged with the fatality of Officer Howard Jones.
I resign. That's really what you want, isn't it?
Then they lost their badges.
What do you think? The department is going to go after Hojo's killer? What the hell do you think that FBI guy was doing at Frank's hearing?
We can only do this on our own.
You're going to go out and break the law now? Turn into a vigilante?
Without any weapons,
we're going to need money.
They may be off the force, but they're a force.
Sanitation department!
All their own.
Man, if we did this every day, you know where we'd be?
Yeah, we'd be dead.
You're interfering in interests you don't understand, mister.
Now they're going where no cop would dare.
We have those weapons, and we must supply them to our friends now.
You tried to hurt my family.
We got their laundry money.
Ride, mama, ride.
No badges.
I mean, with $22 million, we could buy our own country.
This is the money that killed Howard.
No backup.
Well, if we take this money, we're no better than they are.
There's no backing down. For the last of the finest.
The Last of the Finest came out in 1990. It is sometimes known as Blue Heat, as it was released under that title in Europe and Asia. The story follows Dennehy and his team of cops as they try to bring down a drug smuggling operation. However, as they continue their investigation, they find that the narcotic smuggling is all part of a much bigger conspiracy involving illegal arms sales and anti-communist guerrillas in South America. Matters are further complicated when Dennehy and his team are scapegoated by the police department for a drugs bust gone wrong. Amid the fallout, they resign from the force in order to take justice into their own hands. Alongside Dennehy, we've got a terrific cast of character actors here. So as Big Bri's cop buddies, we've got Bill Paxton, Joe Pantoliano, and Jeff Fahey. Xander Berkeley also turns up in a small role, as does Brian Dennehy's daughter, Kathleen. And if you watch a lot of other 80s B-movies, there are a few other familiar faces in there as well. But Last of the Finest was directed by John McKenzie, who people may know from his work directing the spy thriller The Fourth Protocol. And he also did the British gangster classic The Long Good Friday. This film has a 5.8 rating on IMDb and a frankly ridiculous 24% user rating on Rotten Tomatoes. There wasn't a lot of votes on that, so I think perhaps statistically, perhaps that 24% is not terribly valid. Does seem absurdly low. But with all of that out of the way, Matt, what did you make of Last of the Finest?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, watching a movie like this, you know, 10, even as recently as 5 years ago, but definitely 10, 15, compared to now in the current climate, especially in the United States, where what, you know, people look at the police department, you know, I enjoyed the movie. I really liked Dennehy. I really liked the cast. But I also couldn't help thinking like, okay, taking myself back to 1990, this was very much a police kind of propaganda film, you know, where it's like the police are outgunned in this war on drugs that was still considered a big thing. I mean, this was the Bush administration post Reagan, so he was still kind of furthering this war on drugs thing. And L.A. was considered the epicenter of the whole crack war. You know, so it's like there are a lot of things in there, like that big like front end loader that Dennehy uses to crash through the building of a crack house to get in there and get information on this cartel. I mean, that was a legitimate tactic that they were using in L.A. at that time. And you know, this idea that like, oh, the police, you know. You know, these good cops, they could really go in there and clean up crime. But you know what? The justice system is set up to protect the criminals. Mm. And these good cops, they just, you know, they've got to go through all this red tape and they just can't do their job. And man, if it was only that we just got rid of this red tape and we didn't make the laws. And so then, of course, what happened was people went into the voting booths and they started voting for things like, you know, a more militarized police force, you know, getting, you know, more acquisition on like actual machines that allowed them to do what the front end loader did in that vehicle. And so, you know, at the time, I wouldn't have thought anything of it. I would have just been like, man, yeah, that's right. You know, these poor cops, it's too bad that Dennehy can't just do his job. And you realize now you're like, OK, no, this was more to kind of sell us on this idea. And you know, when Clinton comes into office in 92, one of the first things he does is sign an order that allowed L.A. to like hire, I think, like extra like, you know, like tens of thousands of more cops to just sort of like, you know, bolster their police force. And we found out, of course, that the people, they didn't really vet them that well. So it was like all kinds of crime and corruption was happening in L.A. kind of post Rodney King. So it's a very interesting thing to watch into that, because it's like I'm watching it. I'm like, boy, I'm really enjoying a lot of this stuff. But I'm realizing, too, that I'm being sold on this idea that, like, boy, these poor cops, if we could just give them a better system, that this is a system in America is designed to help the criminals and not the cops. And so and I think they kind of tried to parse it a little bit by shoehorning in that whole Iran-Contra thing at the end. But it's a fun actioner for sure. I think if you just know you're being sold something that's not real, you can kind of divorce that part and enjoy the explosions and the shootouts and things like that.
Well, thanks for that little setting this film in its historical context. You know, this is the value you add to these shows, Matt. But I mean, for myself, I thought there was a lot of good things here. It's got some great actors, and they do some nice work in various scenes. There's some good action, but there's just something missing. And I was trying to really sort of put my finger on it. And I think maybe it's just that somehow there's just nothing outstanding. I don't think there's any great scene where you would just sort of like, oh yeah, I saw this film the other day, and you know, it's got all these actors in, and oh, but you know, there's this one scene, this fantastic scene where X happens. But and I think Last of the Finest just lacks that one sort of element that just sort of really sparkles and really makes it stand out. So I mean, it's really good. It's good. It's almost very good. But I couldn't really. Solid basically is the word that comes to mind, and even that maybe slightly undersells it, because I think this is solid in the best possible way. But I don't know, do you think I'm missing out on something here?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think for me, sort of the two big scenes are the beginning where they raid the meatpacking plant, and the very end, which we'll talk about. And it feels like in the middle there's a lot of just these little kind of middling action scenes that you know, if you're watching a five-act television show, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. You know, that'd be the kind of thing that would get me to come back after the commercial with something like that. But in a film, I thought this was a TV movie until I heard Dennehy swear in the first, like, few minutes. And I looked it up and I realized, like, this was an Orion, which it actually kind of makes sense that it was Orion, because, you know, we know Orion didn't do the best work towards the end there. And, you know, maybe they were trying to split the difference. Maybe they thought this would be something that they could pitch on television as well. I don't know, but you're right. It feels like they have these really great bookends, and then in the middle, there's just a lot of these little tiny things that for a feature film don't really carry it.
Yeah, and I mean, let's dig into to some of those sort of elements a little bit, because there are a couple of interesting aspects to the plot here in what is otherwise kind of quite a sort of routine cop thriller about police trying to sort of bust a drugs smuggling operation. And the first of them is that there's this a very clear sort of moralistic tale that's trying to be told here. So there is a subplot that involves a huge haul of drug money that the cops come into possession of. This is after they've resigned from the force in disgust at being prevented from going after these guys properly. And this means then that we sort of have a bit of a debate between the cops and their families about whether they keep the money or not. And for me, Matt, I'll just lay my cards on the table straight away. I just didn't quite think they made that aspect of the film work. And I think where it went wrong for me was it just never really felt like these men would make the wrong choice. I don't know if that chimes with you.
Yeah, and I think the other problem with this is that this situation happens at like the hour and a half mark. So it's not like the film is sort of like, okay, at the half hour mark, maybe they get wind that these drug dealers are going to come in with all this money, and that's their plan, is to steal the money. And then as the film goes on, it's more of a crisis of conscience, and the drug dealers are coming after them, and that's where the action happens. It's more like at the hour and a half mark, you're thinking either A, they steal the money and you wrap up with this nice crane kind of overhead shot of them relaxing in Cabo or someplace nice, and they did okay, and we think, okay, that's great, roll credits, you know. Or they steal the money and they're using it as a way to get the criminals, maybe, or you know, and the fact that there was this debate over it, you're right, it didn't fit at the 90 minute mark. It felt like either this is the movie and that this should be happening way before that, or this isn't the movie, and you're right. Like, we it shouldn't even be a debate. It's more like we're going to use this money as a way to lure the criminals out, and that's how we're going to catch them.
Yeah, I mean, because we've seen in an earlier scene, these men resigned on principle about, you know, not being able to sort of go after these criminals. So, it just doesn't – it's not the idea that they would be tempted – to keep the money is just not sufficiently established in the film. You know, there's various ways they could have done it. You know, maybe one character, you know, maybe they could have set one character up to be, you know, the guy who's really arguing for, like, you know, for them to keep the money. And so then there's a tension between the group as they try to sort of resolve that particular issue. And it just leads to, you know, just the film sort of spins its wheels a little bit in that section, because I just don't really see that it's going to go in any sort of interesting direction. But there was another aspect to it that I did find. I guess you could go either way on it. You could really hate it, or you could quite like it. I think I quite liked it, which was, I mean, there's some pretty sort of sledgehammer symbolism here with this money, because when they get hold of it, they have to decide where they're going to stash this money, and they end up putting it in this, you know, septic tank. So we get a scene where, you know, Brian Dennehy's up to his waist in, you know, stuff that's been flushed down a toilet, and he's stomping on these bags of money, kind of pushing them down into all this sewage. And, you know, you don't need a doctorate in film studies to sort of pick out the symbolism there.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, this movie had a lot of it, right? They had a lot of that kind of stuff in there, you know, that, yeah, the money is definitely dirty money. And we're going to talk about probably how that ends up kind of, you know, what happens at the end of the film with that. You know, just the fact that they choose football, you know, American football as the sport, as opposed to, you know, softball. Normally you'd be doing a softball league with your guys, and they choose football as a way to show that these are kind of rough and tumble blue collar guys that are just in there trying to do the right thing for everybody. And look at these all-American boys out there throwing the football around. And, you know, and the DEA agent are playing against them, and now they start giving forearm shivers and, you know, taking them down. Yeah, there were a lot of these little elements that kind of give you this sense of, like, who these people are and how we're supposed, you know, why we should be rooting for them.
Yeah, you mentioned the football aspect. And just to explain that for anyone listening, I don't even know if it's a subplot that runs through this film. There's where we see sort of Brian Dennehy. He's part of a LAPD American, I don't know what you call it, touch football team. And they're playing different, at different points in the film, they play different law enforcement departments and divisions. And the film, I thought the opening scene was absolutely fantastic, where we sort of drop in on Dennehy, and everyone's like, you know, looking at him with, you know, focused attention, and he's giving them this briefing, which, because we know they're cops, we kind of think, oh, they must be about to go and kick in someone's door. But actually, he's really just briefing them for, you know, the next play that they're going to be doing in this football match that they are in the midst of. And I have to say, you know, I want to see Brian Dennehy make a American football movie. Like, I don't care that he, you know, he was in his 50s or something when he made this. I want to see him making, you know, his kind of work touch football team movie.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Now, yeah, now what they were doing was, I don't know if you see the movie, or I don't know if you have something similar in England with rugby, but it's what we call flag football, where you have little flags attached, kind of like tucked inside your pants or your shorts or whatever. And so instead of tackling somebody, what you do when the person runs by with the football, you rip the flag off of their out of their pants.
Got it.
Essentially. And that means they've been tackled. Mm. That's the idea. So the idea is supposed to be that there's not supposed to be really any kind of physical aspect other than maybe, you know, blocking to keep somebody from getting the quarterback. Yeah, and so, you know, when you see Dennehy in it, you're right. I mean, he's really in his element playing that and doing that in that movie. And, yeah, I mean, like I said, the closest thing he came was he played a college basketball coach from the United States here. But, I mean, at that point, he was also older. You know, he's playing the coach. He's not actually playing the sport or anything. But, yeah, and, of course, Gladiator, he did boxing. But, yeah, I don't think we ever really got to see. This might be the closest we got to see. I mean, he's done so many movies, so maybe somebody out there will hear and be like, no, he did this in a football movie. But I think this might be the closest we get to see him doing American football.
Well, there's another interesting plot angle that I think we should probably sort of get into a little bit here. We've already touched upon it a little bit, which basically the plot here sort of involves the money from these drug sales in the US being used to fund these anti-communist guerrillas in South America. And, you know, this has, you know, very strong echoes of the Iran-Contra scandal, which happened, you know, a few years before this film came out. And if you want to know all the details, I mean, you can go away and look them up. But, you know, very briefly, officials in the American government broke the law by illegally selling weapons to Iran in order to raise funds for the Contra guerrillas in Nicaragua. And there was also some other sort of strands of it where by the CIA were accused of complicity in sales of drugs in the US in order to sort of help finance those operations here. And so we see that echoes of that particular scandal. Well, more than echoes. I mean, it's woven into the plot of the film here. I mean, Matt, what did you make of this? Because this, as I say, Somebody Lived Through the Times, yeah, like I could immediately understood the reference, and it was something that cropped up in, you know, it's very sort of popular sort of plot device in a lot of films that sort of came out late '80s, early '90s.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing because probably, you know, just before this period, it would have been all over the TV with Oliver North, you know, I mean, those hearings were held during the day, all day on network TV. So, you know, like all around the world, you know, people couldn't watch their soap operas, their daytime talk shows, all of those things because Oliver North was on there. And I think one of the things I think most Americans didn't quite get it was very, I don't know if esoteric is the right word, but there were a lot of moving parts with it. And I think most Americans, they have this mindset when it comes to this kind of thing that the government's going to be shady no matter what. I think that's why they forgive a lot of what Donald Trump does, because they think that every politician does what Donald Trump does, when that's not really true, but that's their mindset. They think that Obama was, pardoning all of his cronies and all that. That's what they tell themselves. And so these things don't stick to him as much. And I think, you know, with this movie, I think it does play into that part, because it's, you know, these government actors that are doing this kind of thing. And that's just a mindset that a lot of, especially, you know, working class Americans have, that, you know, I mean, you did a movie called Amerigeddon where you were,
yes,
they talked about the UN and you know, the mindset is like, well, you know, in America is that the UN wants to take over America, which is the most absurd thing because, you know, like, you know, just thinking about like the police officers, what police officers do in the United States, like if another country's government, you know, like their military were doing some of those things, the UN would put out a very harsh note about how they shouldn't be doing that, you know, like, a, you know, like, we really condemn that this government did that. They don't necessarily do anything about it, but they would harshly condemn it. They don't really condemn much of what the United States does that's kind of along that line. But so this movie definitely plays into that idea of that it's this idea that the government does shady things and, you know, it's these hardworking, you know, just, you know, regular Joes like these four guys here that are the ones that stand up for what's right and what's good and all that stuff. And it's interesting because it didn't really stick to Reagan either. You know, he's still kind of lauded on the right, especially as his hero. It didn't really stick to him either, despite the fact that it was, you know, it was done under his watch. I think that's where the whole deep state thing comes in here in the United States, where people talk about this deep state that does things against Donald Trump. This is kind of along those lines back then, you know, 30 years ago. It's still building that, you know, planting that seed. And so, yeah, it's funny watching it now. I think back in 1990, I would have watched it, probably thought the same thing. Like, yeah, our CIA, they're shady. They're always doing all kinds of shady stuff. And this is just part of it. Whereas now I look at it and say, like, no, there's sort of a message in there, you know, that there's a concept or an idea. And this is trying to sell it, you know, using the Iran-Contra thing to sell it.
Well, there are a few other elements of this film which I just really enjoyed, I think, in one way or another, just as somebody who's watched a lot of cop action thrillers here. I really enjoyed the music score for this film because it had that, I guess I think of it as the Lethal Weapon guitar licks all over the soundtrack.
Yes, for sure. I mean, this is kind of a hallmark of Orion, right, at this period. I mean, they put out RoboCop, which was a real inspired film, but for the most part, they were kind of just, you know, trying to do their best to do whatever else was out there. And this definitely feels like that, right? This feels like it's trying to be like the cop movie from that time period. And I also really loved when they do steal the money and they're playing Tom Jones as they're escaping. That was a nice touch. I enjoyed that kind of thing. So yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, the music definitely set the mood and it worked in that sense.
And we've referred to the fact that this film's got a really, you know, stellar cast of great character actors here. You know, who anyone in particular catch your eye for, you know, for doing some particularly good work or maybe disappointing you? I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, Jeff Fahey is one that, you know, thinking of PM Entertainment flicks, you know, I liked him. You know, I think one of the hard parts for me, you know, you see him in the PM Entertainment flicks and you kind of want him to be sort of unleashed. And that wasn't going to happen in this movie. And that was kind of too bad. And I think Joe Pantoliano, it could have been more Joe Pantoliano there. I think that's, you know, when you think of like what he did in like The Sopranos, you know, films like that. I mean, and the movie Bound there that the Wachowskis did before they could, do, when they Matrix, the movie they had to do, they had to prove that they could do The Matrix by making that movie.
He's very subdued here, isn't he?
Yeah, it's almost like, yeah, and we're used to seeing a little bit more Joe Pantoliano. I just think of him in The Sopranos, that one season that he was in there, he was fantastic. I mean, one of my favorites is they call his phone and you get his voice message. Yeah. And he says something along the lines of like, please leave your number because I have no time to look up phone numbers. And it was just like perfect in that character. He says it perfectly. And yeah, I think, you know, this character here, it's almost like they didn't know what they wanted to do with him. And maybe it wasn't, they weren't expecting to get an actor of the caliber of Joe Pantoliano to play the part. So it's kind of like, if this is just a one-off guy, who's not really, you know, known for a lot, this is the part we write for him. And then it turns out it's Pantoliano. And then it's like, well, you know, they can't really change it. Maybe that's what happened.
And you mentioned Jeff Fahey here. I don't know. I mean, did you notice the sort of mascara that he seemed to be wearing throughout the entirety of this film? I mean, he's got a load of mascara on, and there's a couple of scenes where he's wearing this this leather jacket, and it sort of starts to look like he's modeling himself on Al Pacino in Cruising.
Yeah, I mean, they were trying to make him out to be like the young, cool guy in the group, right? The younger, cooler guy, right? He's the one who's not married, doesn't have any kids, right? I think that was just his girlfriend, right? She wasn't his wife. Yeah. You know, like you talk about the leather jackets, he had like kind of light colored polos underneath with the collars popped. And you're right about the mascara. I mean, they were doing a lot to try to make him into something that he didn't necessarily have to be, but I guess they felt like they had to have this like younger person in the group. And he wasn't even younger. I know he's older than Paxton, I think. And he may even be older than Pantoliano. So he wasn't even like the youngest of the group. He may have been the second oldest. And he was playing this role as like the younger, cooler guy or something like that. And yeah, they didn't really know how to do it.
Well, we've been talking about actors, and obviously the reason we're doing this show is because of Brian Dennehy. So let's spend a few sort of moments looking at him in this film. And there's a really nice scene that I liked in this film where we see the characters. It's quite early on in the film. We see the characters at some sort of beach party, or it's on a pier that's right next to the beach, and we just get to see these characters hanging out with each other, and you know, we get to see Brian Dennehy doing a bit of dad dancing as well, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
yes, it was, and of course, you know, again, classic you know, blue collar mindset of like, he doesn't like the music, right? I can't dance to this music, right? I need some good old-fashioned rock and roll, right? You know, this is Mexican music or something like that, you know, kind of a veiled sort of, I don't want to say racist, but at that time, you know, veiled for racially insensitive comment about, you know, what was going on there. And but again, like, yeah, it's sort of like he knows what this character's supposed to do, so like all of these little things that he's doing are meant to endear him more to us. So I agree with you there. It was kind of funny. I mean, that whole sequence there, where they're at the party, was, and of course the way they use that to introduce all of the characters. So that's how we know Fahey's the young guy, and, you know, Bill Paxton's kind of the goofier guy and all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
On the Simplistic Reviews podcast, we talk movies. We talk TV. We talk.
Hello, Julie, what the heck are you doing?
Trying to make our spot sound more exciting by adding explosions.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could have got the point across with sound effects, not the real thing.
Download the show on iTunes or at simplisticreviews.blogspot.com.
I'm sure your insurance company will cover that.
No, they won't.
No, they probably won't.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This happens at the film's finale between Dennehy and his buddies and the bad guys. There's a big midnight showdown at a deserted baseball field where when the exchange predictably goes to hell, there's a big gunfight. One of the villains has arrived in a helicopter and seeks to make his getaway in it. However, before it can fly away, the tail rotor is hit by gunfire from the police. The chopper spins around, crashes into the floodlights before falling to the ground and exploding. So, Matt, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
Yeah, this was one of the highlights of the film for me. I thought this was a really good one. You know, I was throughout the movie, I'm watching this thing like, I think PM Entertainment could do this movie better, you know, kind of incrementally. But I think the exploding helicopter, I think if this was a PM flick, they would just use an old exploding helicopter. Or I guess this was a 1991, so this would have been the one that they would have made that all the other movies would have used. But that was the one. I really liked it. I thought there were it looked really nice. It was a good one. I didn't think it was going to be as nice as it was, the way they were setting it up. Yep. I thought it might have just been like a kind of a dud where it just kind of lands on the ground and crashes a little bit. But I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that you get to see this, you know, it's part of a nice sequence. So we see this helicopter sort of, you know, trying to take off and escape, and you know, being hit by gunfire. There is a sort of detail that I've missed out actually in terms of this sequence, because the helicopter's getaway is complicated by the fact that as it tries to lift off, it's now been covered in excrement from the septic tank where Dennehy's hidden the money, because he has booby-trapped it with some explosives, and so it's killed these bad guys who are trying to recover the money. And it's also then sent all this sewage is now all splattered over the windscreen of the helicopter, so the pilot can't see what he's doing, and that plays into the fact that their liftoff is pretty ineffective, and that the helicopter then crashes into these floodlights. But once it hits the ground, I mean, we get to see what looks like it looks like they've kind of got some old fuselage of a helicopter, and that they've stuck some pyrotechnics into it, so it's a pretty sort of decent looking you know, crash down and explosion. And you know, we get to see there's some nice lingering shots of the wreckage, which are sort of shot in slow-mo, so we can enjoy the flames you know, devouring the carcass of this now downed chopper.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that a first, that a helicopter covered in sewage? Like, had that ever happened, or that you'd seen before?
I have never seen that before. So that is a unique detail, which I really, 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 really enjoyed. So, I think, you know, I think we're playing safe here by calling it sewage. I think listeners should draw their own conclusions as to what's really coated all over the front of that helicopter. But, I definitely the first time that substance has been used to help blow up a helicopter.
And I one thing I did love, I mean, because it was funny, because, you know, we always have that, a lot of times we have that this idea of like the pilot is the one who's like, no, we shouldn't be flying right now, but the baddie's like, no, we got to get out of here, you got to, you know, lift this thing off the ground or whatever. And just the fact that it was, I can't see out of the windscreen, you know, I can't see where I'm going. That's why we shouldn't be flying right next to it. I don't think I've ever heard that either. I don't think I can remember a time where it was like, you know, usually it's like, oh, I can't lift up because we can't take off because this thing is holding us down, or, you know, we can't take off because of whatever the reason. The fact that it was, we can't take off because I can't see, because sewage covered our you know, the windshield, like that was a great one too, a great take on that helicopter pilot saying we can't take off.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Matt, thank you so much for coming back on. It was an absolute blast. Do you want to take a moment to tell people about where they can find you and find the DTV Connoisseur?
Yeah, so everything is based off the website, which is dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com. I've recently upgraded a little bit. I did put a new background, but then also I've recently reset it so that the text itself is on a black background. So you can see our new kind of vaporwave background, and then you can read the text there. But that's where the links are to everything. All the social media, my new novel that's out, Chad and Accounting, you can get the link to that there as well. And then our thread list that we just started, if you want to get any direct-to-video connoisseur merch, that's also on the website. So everything is dtvconnoisseur.blogspot.com.
Yeah, go and check it out. You're bound to find some great stuff. I know I have over the years. As always, if you could rate, review, or retweet Exploding Helicopter, we'd be very grateful. Don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website. We'll be back soon. But until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Fellas, now listen up. This is it. Now, Wayne, I want you to look for a side door before you go in. We may just get lucky. All right, Ricky, you gotta be ready to move, boy. I may have to come to you before I really want to. Hojo, now Ricky will be there to cover you. I expect him to be all over me like a cheap overcoat. So one of you guys should be open. All right, we all know what it took to get here. We know we're the best. Now we've gotta prove it. Let's go. Yeah.